Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writermichaelswanson.com for more details. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest is Phil Giraldi. He's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. And he's a contributing editor at the American Conservative Magazine and regular contributor to antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today. So the all the headlines are from over the weekend that Barack Obama told the Israelis, go ahead and bomb whatever in Syria you want, and they took him up on that, and they started bombing some things. Can you please fill us in on what you know?
Well, I don't know if it was quite that emphatic in terms of Obama telling him to go ahead and bomb. I think basically he's acquiescing with what the Israelis are doing. I think he's demonstrated otherwise that he's fairly timid about what's going on in Syria, which is, of course, probably the right way to go. But anyway, neither here nor there. There are a couple of, if you go to the Israeli media, there are a number of different stories about what was bombed and why it was bombed. The initial accounts were that it was a movement of chemical weapons, which didn't make much sense at all. And the more recent account is that it was anti-aircraft missiles, which they felt were being put on trucks to be moved somewhere, and the suspicion was it might be going to Lebanon. So those are the two accounts. And then there are a number of other stories about other Israeli intentions, about creating a buffer zone inside Syria, attacking what they are describing as an Iranian intelligence collection base. So I don't know. Obviously, there's the Israelis are into it now. Obama's not going to stop them. And it's not really clear to me what exactly their objective might be.
Well, you know, Paul Pilar, the former CIA analyst who writes for the National Interest, had a thing where he was, I think he was citing the Daily Star or another Lebanese source, where they're speculating that maybe what this means is by throwing in on the side of the rebels, the Israelis are actually deliberately trying to sabotage them and make them look like the puppets of the Israelis in order to defuse their revolution, because maybe they changed their mind and they prefer Assad after all. What do you think of that? I don't think Pilar endorses that necessarily. He was just mentioning that as one of the theories going around.
Yeah, well, that demonstrates, I think, how crazy the whole situation is, because normally when you see one of these situations, it's clear what the players are trying to do, and in this case, Israeli intervention in Syria is only going to damage the government unless you get really convoluted about it, and basically it's going to lead to a regime that, from one viewpoint, benefits the Israelis, and that it's going to be weak and divided. But on the other hand, it also could be extremely radical. It's kind of a flip of a coin. I don't get what the Israelis are doing. I don't, to a large extent, I don't even get what the United States game is in Syria anymore. I probably never did right from the beginning. But it's becoming increasingly difficult to see any kind of plan of action. I guess you know that in Washington there was a mini conference last week at the John McCain Foreign Policy Institute, in which the subject was, can we save Syria?
Oh, man. Well, and of course, actually it was the president who kind of sounded like he'd been listening to the show a little bit when he said, I mean, this is really surprising for this level of argument on that level of public debate, where he said, you know, who says that, I think it was the New Republic interview, who says that if we intervene that the violence will be decreased? I mean, hey, we might just really stumble into something much, much worse. So, I mean, it ain't ever voted for the guy, but you got to admit he's better than Mitt Romney or John McCain on this issue for sure. You know, just the fact that he's scared, like, good, you know?
Yeah.
The guy's not brave enough to get us into this challenge, you know?
Yeah, well, I hope he's not brave enough. But I think you may have seen the news article that came out today about how Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, said that the situation in Helmand province was a lot more stable before the British military arrived. So it kind of tells you that the unintended consequences of a military intervention, what they might be.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess I could imagine a president thinking that way, but talking that way, wow, that's like a real threshold. I guess times are really bad when the president really has to work hard to defend his decision to only throw in halfway on the side of the suicide bomber veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq fighting against Assad in Syria.
Well, but didn't he also explain that the money would be used to buy them warm clothes for the winter?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing the whole time. In fact, you're the guy who broke the story, Phil, and I don't know who your sources were, but they were pretty good ones when you reported in December of 2011 that he had signed a finding authorizing the CIA to, I don't know, the way you put it, at least step up covert operations in Iran and Syria both, and I guess that meant coordinating the Free Syrian Army and the Saudis and the Qataris and the money and the weapons, no?
Yeah, well, and I think I was the first one in January who described how they were getting the weapons in. They were flying them in on NATO airplanes. That was back in January of last year.
Yeah.
So, this has been going on for a year.
They really have been arming. I mean, come on. When Ronald Reagan was selling weapons to the Israelis and then the Israelis were selling weapons to the Iranians, nobody bought that. All it did was implicate the Israelis too, but it didn't exonerate the Americans that they had this very obvious, quote unquote, plausible deniability that it was somebody else that was selling the TOW missiles to the Ayatollah, right? I mean, why should it be if Obama launders the actual money and weapons through Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who get all their stuff from us anyway, right? Then why should that matter? Hasn't he been arming these guys just outright this whole time?
Well,
and then
yeah,
just calling it that he's reluctant but doing it anyway?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that basically this started out by shifting some of the weapons that were in gross numbers in Libya onto vessels that were making ports of call in places where the weapons could be received, probably in south of Turkey, and also flying some of them in. And so it started out small, but essentially I think it's continued since that time. Now, the rebels, of course, have been complaining they're not getting weapons, and I think that's an indication of Turkey kind of backing out of the deal. Turkey's beginning to see that there's a lot of downside to what's going on in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Well, but what about the Saudis and the Qataris? Are they still just pushing on?
Well, the Saudis and Qataris definitely are pushing on. They're the paymasters for all of this. They're sending money and everything in, but the weapons have to come through Turkey. I mean, there's no other alternative except Lebanon, and that doesn't work very well either. So they really have to come from Turkey. Now, an interesting sidebar to all of this is, I don't know how closely you're following everything that's been going on in Egypt, but it's the Saudis and Qataris who are messing around in Egypt, too. And what they're doing is they're funding the opposition. And now you're hearing this first from me, Scott. They're funding the opposition. The idea is to make the current regime look bad, which is bad enough as it is. But what they really want is a return to some kind of quasi-military rule.
The Saudis and the Qataris, they don't feel comfortable with the Muslim Brotherhood running Egypt?
Well, Muslim Brotherhood is not really in bed with the Saudis and Qataris. They have their own brand of fundamentalism, as I'm sure you know. And basically, they see the whole situation in Egypt as dangerous in terms of destabilizing their own populations and their own interests. So they like a nice, comfortable, Mubarak-style government of national unity in which the military is calling, most of the shots. And that's what they're aspiring to do. But I heard from a very reliable source a couple of days ago that over $1 billion has gone to the so-called protesters in various guises. And this very often the protests are being led by junior army officers in civilian clothes. So this is something that apparently our intelligence agencies know all about. but they don't know what to do with it.
Huh. Well, now, and does that include the labor union and the more liberal-leaning protesters, or that's just the Salafists, or
no,
both?
No, I'm not including the actual, you know, some of the actual genuine protesters who started this whole process.
So they're not even, it's not even really that they've infiltrated them so much as they're just got, you know, undercover provocateurs in plain clothes out there getting the work done.
Right. They're doing a rent-a-crowd type deal.
Uh-huh.
Where you get people out in the street, and you give them a little money, and you tell them they can loot. And off they go. When that happens, it invites an overreaction from the government, which means through the police forces, which we've seen. And the situation escalates. And the Egyptian chief of staff last week suggested that there might have to be a, quote, military intervention. So that's the way it's going. But it's to me, the interesting part of the story is it's the Saudi Arabians and the Gulf states that are behind it.
Yeah. Well, and I guess America and Saudi Arabia have been running a counter-revolution since, well, the whole time, really. I mean, ever since, I guess, Tunisia took them by surprise, but in Egypt, they worked really hard to keep Mubarak as long as they could. And then in every other place, in Yemen and in Bahrain and everywhere else, I guess in Kuwait, and increasing everybody's welfare was enough, but pretty much everywhere else, they had to bring out the truncheons at the very least across the world and put all these revolutions down, at least for a time. Less, of course, Libya and Syria, where they're trying to co-opt it and make it their own. But
yeah, that's right. I mean, you'll never see any evidence of the Saudis or the Gulf states supporting groups like the Muslim Brotherhoods, because basically that group is, to them, as dangerous as you know, democracy. And the point is they have their own brand of fundamentalism. They have their own idea of how a state should be run, and it's rather authoritarian.
Well, is that why al-Nusra is so far ahead of everybody else in Syria? Because I guess I would have thought that the Muslim Brotherhood would have been, even if, you know, coming from the underground, that they would have been the most organized force to fight any revolution there. But it doesn't look like they're the ones running, as far as I know.
No, they're not. And that's the reason why. The money's not going to them.
Interesting. I mean, wouldn't they have been, before the whole thing started, wouldn't they have been the ones in the best position to actually get the job done if the Saudis supported them, for example?
They had an infrastructure, and they had the capability to do it. And, of course, they have a history of being anti-regime.
Well, now, this brings us back to what you said about weapons being shipped from Libya. I assume you've read Raimondo's column today about this, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Okay, and so you're referring at least to this Times of London report about at least one big boat full of weapons going from Libya to Turkey to go to, well, and then there was a dispute whether the Muslim Brotherhood or others were going to get it, and that was part of the thing that Justin's speculating maybe is what led to the Benghazi attack. But the point I'm interested in is, can you verify, are you verifying, or you're just referring to that Times of London story, or you're telling us, yeah, you're a former CIA guy, and you're telling us, you know that this is right from your own sources, et cetera, like that?
Well, some of the wrinkles are different, but as I say, this has been going on for a lot longer than that ship, and it's been coming in by air, and it's been coming in through NATO channels because NATO had access to the Libyan weapons. So, it's been happening since that time. I don't think there's any question about it.
Yeah. So it was basically just uncountable quantities of Libyan weapons up for grabs after that thing.
Right, and the key player, of course, in all this has been Turkey, which had to provide the access to these weapons, and they were quite willing to do it when it looked like Syria was going to be a 90-day turnaround. But they're not so happy about it now, and so they're basically between a rock and a hard place, and are resisting coming down too hard on the side of the resistance, because the resistance nobody knows what it represents.
Yeah, well, I mean, and they could have, should have known better to even get involved in this thing in the first place. What do you make of Hillary Clinton now apparently leaking to Michael Gordon in the New York Times that, yeah, I tried to get the president to intervene more fully on al-Qaeda's side, but he wouldn't do it?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, it's probably no surprise that there was a split in the cabinet on the issue, and that she came down on the side of wanting to have a military intervention. But, you know, we're not finished with Hillary yet. I mean, her PAC got set up today, I guess it was, for electing her in 2016. Hillary's always been a hawk, and no question about it. And Bill Clinton has been one too. I mean, it's just, why should anybody question it? I mean, it's just the whole saga of what went on in the Balkans was basically his show.
Right. Yeah, well, and also the blockade and the no-fly zone bombings of the 1990s in Iraq that really provoked the September 11th attack. Then, of course, well, maybe you can fill us in on this. Michael Scheuer says that as far as he knows, Clinton had at least 10 different chances to capture or kill bin Laden before 9/11. This guy he provoked into being our enemy and then refused to do anything about.
Yeah, well, if Michael is saying that, I'm sure it's true. The only question in my mind would be, you know, what is he calling an opportunity? I mean, some of the opportunities might have been better than others, and there might have been good reasons for some of those opportunities not being taken advantage of. But yeah, I'm sure if he's saying that, it's correct.
Yeah, I think some of them are kind of widely known, right? Like there was a swing set and kids at the farmhouse, and then one time he was out falconing, but there was some Arabian prince. I remember Scheuer actually said to me, yeah, well, the world's lousy with Arabian princes, all right? Sometimes you just have to kill us on anyway. You know?
Yeah, I like that. That's Michael, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so... So the Israelis are bombing Syria. Let's get back to that. This guy, Netanyahu, is he trying to get into a war here? I mean, the Assad's response was to just sit there and take it, basically. But is that crazy, or how long can we expect that to last?
Well, Assad really has no resources to strike back. That's the fact. And so if I would imagine if Netanyahu decides to occupy 10 more miles of Syria, it would be rather popular in Israel. You know, maybe that's the game he's playing. He still hasn't formed a government, so he's going to be playing off various political interests in attempting to do so. Hell, maybe Ariel Sharon is coming back. I mean, he's coming out of his coma, isn't he?
Nuh-uh. Is that happening for real?
Yeah.
Or you're just saying metaphorically?
No. He's been showing some signs of brain activity and apparently even maybe speaking. That's in the Israeli media. Yeah, sure.
Oh,
sure.
No.
Can you imagine that?
Would that be funny if they made him prime minister again?
Well, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I mean, it would be tragic for all the people who would have to die, but still, you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it would be one of those incredible Mad Magazine moments. Yeah.
My goodness. I'm looking at Google News. I don't see it. Well, maybe I need to put in Ariel with Sharon. That's too easy.
Yeah, type in Ariel Sharon, and you'll come up with reports about his
brain scan shows response
condition.
To stimuli, reports the New York Times. There you go. Yeah. I always wondered, you know, just how dead that guy was.
Yeah.
Apparently not all the way.
I saw one report, I think was one in an Israeli paper, that basically said there actually had been some reports that he had recognized one of his family members and was trying to speak or something. So it's a pretty scary prospect.
Well, I'm actually looking forward to the fight between him and Netanyahu over the future of Likud, you know. That'll
yeah,
be a good time. So do you think that Netanyahu's going to keep bombing Syria for now? I mean, there are plenty of missiles that could be a threat to Israel one day if anybody ever got their hands on them. There's, you know, unlike Iraq, there actually are buildings with some mustard gas in them somewhere, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the stupid thing about this whole Israeli policy, because as long as the government is in control, those chemical weapons are safe. But once you bring down the government or you weaken it sufficiently, suddenly you have people that have access to those weapons who are not responding to central control or orders or anything like that, and could well wind up using them. It's just like this whole thing is insane. And if you can't bomb chemical weapon sites, because that releases the chemicals. So it's kind of a lose-lose situation. So I don't know what they're planning in terms of that. I rather suspect if indeed they think there is some Iranian intelligence operation going on, they'll probably bomb that. But I don't know. It might come down to what are the internal Israeli politics that are involved with this. And if Netanyahu is playing up something to enhance his position to form a government, that could be maybe all it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems like this debate, and, you know, this goes for Iraq and Iran, too, but especially when we're talking about Syria, it's always been the question of just mean and belligerent versus rational on the other side of the argument. I mean, it from the point of view of even the most right-wing nationalists in Israel, who could they possibly have that they could rely on better than Bashar al-Assad to be the dictator of Syria? They would have to be absolutely insane to think they're better off with some kind of giant Lebanon-style 15 years civil war between factions up there. I mean, I could see how, okay, they would have a splintered nation state that would no longer be a threat, but they would have just been like, you know, Mickey Mouse cutting up the broom into just smaller and smaller pieces, more and more enemies.
Well, I think maybe the model is Iraq, and essentially what they would like to see Syria become is like Iraq, basically divided into three constituencies, all of which are weak enough where they don't threaten Israel. But of course, that requires constituencies that have self-identification at such a level that they can come together. And it seems to me Syria is much more diverse than that, and also much more radicalized in terms of the players in this thing. So, it ain't going to work. But, it certainly is in line with what the clean break policy would have recommended. And so I suspect there are probably people in Israel who think that this is some kind of solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, well, it was David Wurmser, Dick Cheney's Middle East advisor, and the guy holding Colin Powell's leash in the first junior term, who wrote, it was a companion piece to A Clean Break, but for the same foundation there in Israel, where he said, in Syria, we need to expedite the chaotic collapse. That way we can, you know, control the future of it and all of that.
That's right.
So, sure doesn't seem to make much sense, really. I mean, I see it does make sense, but I just mean when you weigh it with the pros and cons and the consequences and possible unintended consequences as well as likely ones and all of that, then it just, there's no way it makes sense, but I don't know.
It's kind of one of these situations where there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of logic to it, but maybe we're just missing something. I don't know what exactly the Israelis would see as their interest in Syria. Their interest, it would seem to me, would be having, as you pointed out, a stable Syria controlled by kind of a strong man who keeps everything under wraps, kind of a clone of Mubarak. But obviously that's not what they're pushing for. They're destabilizing the regime, and the result can, in my mind, can only be bad.
Well, now, do your former CIA buds and current CIA buds tell you that they think Assad's going to fall soon, or this thing's just going to drag on forever if the current level of foreign involvement is kept up, or, you know, where do we stand with that?
Well, my sources are saying that basically it's at a stalemate, and that Assad can hang on if he makes the essentially political decision to do so. But as far as in terms of the resources, clearly the Turks are being difficult about letting more weapons through to the rebels, which is a problem for them. And while the Qataris and Saudis can provide money, it's a little more tricky getting weapons into the country. So I don't see where the rebels are necessarily going to get into a stronger position unless they can literally capture weapons from the army, which they're having, I think, some mixed success with.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, what about Jordan? Is they just moving all the bases that they had in Turkey to Jordan now, or what?
Well, Jordan basically is getting overwhelmed by the refugee flow, and that's the other big question about Syria. That you're talking about close to a million refugees right now, who are in various countries, and it's creating major structural and infrastructural problems for those countries. I think Jordan is nervous, extremely nervous about the situation, and is trying to basically not get involved at a serious level, and they're sort of coming around to the views that the Turks have adopted by virtue of having bad policies. So it's kind of a mess. I mean, there's nobody thought through this process when they started it. If that sounds like the history of the last 11 years, I think that's what we're seeing again.
Right. I mean, with Libya, you could tell where this is very much a East versus West kind of thing. And even if it is just special forces and a few militia guys at the front, that as long as they got NATO air power, that even if it takes 9 months, eventually they'll sack Tripoli. And so that's how it worked out. And you could tell that. We could predict that. We didn't know exactly how many months it would take, but we could bet that by the end of 2011, Gaddafi would have been shot in the head on the side of the road. So that was simple enough. But Syria really doesn't seem like it, huh?
Yeah, well, Syria occupies a different position geographically in terms of its importance in the Arab world, and Libya was kind of a big player, but Syria is significant, and I think that they really kind of miscalculated based on what they thought they saw in Libya in terms of what could be accomplished quickly and relatively painlessly, but you know, they were wrong.
It's the Rumsfeld model, right? Light and fast. Get in there and get your regime changed. Well, now, and so how much help are the Russians giving Assad? Are they determined to keep him?
The Russians are, if you follow their comments and their media, they're kind of on both sides of the argument. I mean, they've been critical of Assad, but they basically support him as a sovereignty issue, which is what I've always kind of felt we should have done right from the beginning. That essentially you've been criticized the hell out of him, but at the same time, Assad was the legitimate government of the state of Syria, and he still is. And I think that's where the Russians come down, because once you start playing around with the idea that regime change is possible all over the globe, it then becomes all over the globe. It means that people who believe that Russia is a dictatorship will start playing the same game, or who start going after the various former Soviet republics that are part of the Confederation right now. It's the same game. So I think the Russians have that viewpoint, and I think they're correct.
Well, and yeah, I mean, it's certainly not for the United Nations to decide whether Assad is legit or not. And that's really my problem with this, too. I focus so much on the foreign involvement because that's what's my business, right, is the empire getting involved here. My responsibility is to try to check that in whatever way I can, you know, interviewing people like you about it and informing people about it, that kind of thing. But I'm perfectly happy for the people of Syria to kill Assad to death if that's what they want to do. What right does he have to be their dictator? None whatsoever. It's just that my guys don't have the right to change it is all.
Yeah, that's right. If the Egyptians want to overthrow Mubarak, if the Syrians want to overthrow Assad, if the Iraqis want to overthrow Saddam Hussein, that's fine with me, just like I'm sure with you. But the fact is that it's not our right to intervene in those countries to change their government, to change what the dynamics there are. And the fact that we've gotten this idea that we have some kind of preemptive right to do that is just absurd.
Yeah. Well, and especially when, I mean, if the precedent is anywhere that there's a civil war and people are dying, we have to intervene, then what does that even mean? They're declaring war for or against any armed faction anywhere in the world, right? At any given time.
As long as we disagree with them.
Yeah, exactly. They could be on the side of the state against their local insurgents or on the side of the insurgents against their local state, depending on whether it's Mali or Libya a few hundred miles away.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, where it's somebody friendly to us, somehow we don't seem to get the same the same argument is not produced.
Yeah, that's really the funniest part about this. I mean, with the Iraq war, anyone could have told you, and a lot of us did, hey, don't invade Iraq if what you're trying to limit is, Al-Qaeda-style terrorism, because you're just going to make that problem worse as a side effect, you know, of overthrowing
That's right.
and invading and occupying the country and that kind of thing. But now, in this case, we literally have wars. We're backing Al-Qaeda in Libya and Syria while we're fighting them in Afghanistan and Mali at the exact same time. I mean, if you were in the U.S. Army, wouldn't you be like, what the hell?
I think a lot of people in the U.S. Army are kind of going, what the hell? And I think people at the Pentagon at senior levels are doing the same. None of this makes any sense. If you go back to anti-war, the website back in 2003, you go back to the second year of the American Conservative magazine, you'll find that there were a lot of people, including myself, who were predicting that this is exactly how this would play out. And now here we are, 10 years later, and it's still playing out.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, there's this article, I think it was in UPI, about how, a lot of what's going on in Syria right now is the legacy of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who, of course, the Pentagon begged George Bush, let us kill him before the invasion, because they knew he was going to be such a problem. And Bush refused because he needed that talking point that this guy who was wanted by Saddam and wasn't even friends with Osama was the connection between the two, because he lived in American Kurdistan up in the north. And which was such a ridiculous lie, but they need that excuse to invade. And then he led the suicide bomber brigades for, 2.5 years there, 3 years, until early 2006. And how these are his guys are fighting the revolution in Syria right now.
Yeah, that's right.
The guy who specialized in bombing marketplaces full of Shiite women and children.
That's right. It's a 10-year legacy of really bad policies.
What a disaster. Yeah. The only thing good about it is how hilarious it's going to be in 300 years when they're reading the history of it and doing the Jean-Luc Picard facepalm and just going, man, those Americans are something else.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's hard to even imagine what they would compare us to. I mean, in terms of an empire being so inept. The others managed to pull it off better. I mean, the British and the Romans, and it's just incredible how a country that had aspirations of what amounts to imperial power just never quite figured out how to do it.
Yeah. Well, Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, Napoleon too. That was we're about on that level of overreach now. It seems like to me.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, Russia. I mean, Napoleon didn't invade the Soviet Union. I'm sorry. You know what I mean. All right, we're over time. Thanks for your time, Phil. It's great to talk to you as always.
Okay, Scott. Take care. See bye-bye.
Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit, Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount. The Emergency Committee for Israel, Brookings, Heritage, APAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. They've got a brand new website with new and improved access to more than 20 years worth of essays promoting the cause of liberty. And FFF's writers, including Jacob Hornberger, Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more, aren't just good. They're the best at opposing and discrediting our corrupt overlords in Washington and their warfare, welfare, regulatory police state. That's the Future Freedom Foundation's new and improved site at fff.org.